Casualties rise as Palestinians rally against Israeli forces following an assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque, Muslims' third holiest site. Russia warns the United States of unpredictable consequences if Washington keeps arming Ukraine. Plus, Yemen says the Saudi-led coalition is still continuing to violate terms of a UN-brokered ceasefire by seizing fuel ships and obstructing the flights. Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to protest Israeli crackdown in the occupied Al-Quds area. Rally comes amid a surge in Israeli violations against the holy city. The Palestinian Red Crescent says more than 340 Palestinians have been injured in Israeli attacks across the West Bank. Chef Shannon has your details.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear full responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vow to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
This rally is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire, and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Israeli regime. He says developments unfolding in Muslims' third holiest site shows Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving and that Israel is in a state of desperation. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments during a phone call with Ismail Haniyeh, head of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement. Amir Abdullahian said the resistance is now at its peak, while the Israeli regime has never been weaker. He said Iran supports the establishment of an integrated Palestinian state across historical territories with Al-Quds as its capital. The top Iranian diplomat said raid on Palestinian worshippers is one of the adverse consequences of a few Arab countries normalizing ties with the Israelis. For his part, Haniyeh said Palestinians have two options before them, submission to the Judaization of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or resistance against Israel, and he said that they have chosen the latter. Reactions are pouring in following a surge in Israeli violations against Palestinians in Al-Quds. Organization of Islamic Cooperation has called on the international community to put an end to repeated Israeli aggression. Iraq has also condemned the high rate of violence in Palestinian territories and the expansion of Israeli operations in Palestinian cities and villages. Saudi Arabia slammed Israeli attacks, saying that the international community must hold Tel Aviv accountable. Also, the U.S. is urging all sides to exercise restraint and avoid provocative actions. Washington says it's deeply concerned about a new round of escalations. Several other countries and groups have also criticized the Israeli attacks. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Arab countries' normalization of ties with Tel Aviv was a green light for Israelis to continue crimes against Palestinians.
It's a green light for the Israeli settlers to go ahead with their crimes against the Palestinians, to go ahead with raiding Al-Aqsa Mosque complex anytime they want. Of course, when the Israeli, when the Israelis and the Israeli settlers watch and see that, let's say, major Arab countries declaring normalization of ties, visiting Israel and holding summits with Israeli officials, then they know that those countries would not be backing and supporting the Palestinians or their cause, even if they say that the Palestinian cause remain as a priority for them. But on ground, it's not anymore, because they preferred the Israeli authorities on the Palestinians. Of course, this is what the Palestinians are saying today. They are left alone. That's why the unity is the most thing needed now. Palestinians are today united, not only for the issue of Al-Aqsa or defending Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds, but also in the last few days, everyone watched Israeli forces raiding West Bank cities and villages, killing Palestinians in cold blood. And even experts have described these killings as extrajudicial killings, because at the end of the day, the Israeli soldiers know very well that they will not be punished or prosecuted for their crimes against Palestinians.
Now, we spoke to a Palestinian journalist and activist, Khaled Barakat. He's spoke about the reasons behind the Israeli attacks on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan.
If you look at why escalation happens, even in previous years, you will see that it is the same reasons where settlers who are fanatic, extremist, racist, colonialist, who comes from New York, London, and Berlin, have instigate these issues against Palestinians and against Muslims in the Holy Land of Holy Month of Ramadan. And at the same time, Israel is provoking this not only in Jerusalem, but throughout Palestine. Now, the Palestinian people are aware of these Israeli schemes. They are united against Israel more than ever before.
A senior Yemeni official says the Saudi-led coalition continues to violate terms of a two-month-long ceasefire by seizing Yemeni-bound fuel shipments and obstructing flights. Yemeni Deputy Foreign Minister Hussein Al-Ezzi rejected the United Nations claims that Riyadh is adhering to the truce, saying that UN statements are aimed at concealing the aggression on part of the Saudi coalition. Yemen had previously stated it will commit to the truce as long as the other side adheres to it as well. On April 2nd, a ceasefire was announced by UN Special Envoy for Yemen and welcomed by warring sides. The truce stipulates halting offensive military operations and the siege on Yemen for a period of 2 months. Now, Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war against the country back in early 2015 in collaboration with a number of its allies. Russia has warned the U.S. of unpredictable consequences if Washington and its allies continue to send weapons to Ukraine. According to U.S. media reports, Moscow has sent diplomatic notes to Washington and other countries, urging them to stop irresponsible militarization of Ukraine. Russia has also accused NATO of trying to force Kiev to abandon negotiations in order to continue the bloodshed. The warning comes 2 days after the U.S. president announced an additional $800 million in military aid to Ukraine. Earlier Wednesday, Russia warned NATO that it will treat arms shipments to Ukraine as legitimate targets. Moscow said any effort to inflict damage on Russian military will be harshly suppressed. Tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine show no signs of abating. Moscow has now announced the expulsion of 18 members of the European Union mission, that is, the EU mission, in a tit-for-tat move. The Russian Foreign Ministry declared EU staff persona non grata. The ministry said that they have to leave Russia in the very near future. It also summoned the EU ambassador to hand him a note of protest and blamed the bloc for destroying bilateral relations. EU has lashed out at Moscow for expelling its diplomats. Have a listen.
The European Union deplores the unjustified, baseless decision of the Russian Federation to expel 18 members of the delegation of the European Union to the Russian Federation.
Earlier this month, the EU declared 19 Russian diplomats persona non grata and ordered them to leave the host nation, Belgium. Now, the bloc accused the Russians of engaging in activities contrary to their diplomatic status. Russia has already said it will respond to all such expulsions. Meanwhile, Russia has once again warned Sweden and Finland against their intention to join NATO.
The choice is up to the authorities of Sweden and Finland, but they should understand the consequences of such a step for our bilateral relations and for the architecture of European security as a whole.
Maria Zakharova said the potential membership of the two into NATO will not beef up their national security and enhance their international image. On Thursday, Moscow also warned there could be no more talk of a nuclear-free status for the Baltic if the two countries join the U.S.-led military alliance. Finland said this week it will decide whether to apply for NATO membership within weeks, and then Sweden is also mulling the matter. Russia stands strongly opposed to NATO's eastward expansion and views it as a security threat. The UN says more than 5 million people have fled Ukraine since the start of the Russian offensive on the 24th of February. UN High Commissioner for Refugees said over 4.7 million Ukrainian nationals have fled across the borders, and the UN's International Organization for Migration said nearly 215,000 third country nationals have also been forced to leave Ukraine. Now, figures come after Ukraine said last week that 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from the besieged eastern regions. According to UN figures, 90% of refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities are not allowing men of military age to leave the country. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. CIA Director William Burns has accused China of being a silent partner in what he called Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Burns said China poses the greatest challenge the U.S. intelligence agency has ever faced. He added Chinese President Xi Jinping is a formidable competitor lacking in neither ambition nor capability. Burns made the comments during his first public speech as CIA director. He said it's more a complicated and contested world in light of what he called an adversarial China and revisionist Russia. Ties have soured between the U.S. and China over the past several years, as Beijing has stood up against what it sees as Washington's hegemony. U.S. says China is helping Russia evade Western sanctions imposed over Ukraine, something that Beijing denies. Another unarmed black man has been killed by police in America. The latest episode is another reminder there's no end in sight to the deep-rooted problem of police violence against people of color.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem.
Michigan police killing an unarmed black man has drawn condemnation from activists. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has called it horrifying, heartbreaking, and deeply frustrating. Activists are especially angry with senators who block legislation aimed at reforming policing in America.
The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Amazon's high-pressure operations keep resulting in worker injuries in unprecedented numbers, and the situation is worsening, says Jessica Corbett, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Staggering Analysis Finds Amazon's Injury Rate Rose 20% Last Year. Stay tuned for more. As the United States unionization movement elevates criticism of Amazon's labor conditions, an analysis published recently exposed a 20% rise in injuries among company warehouse workers last year, while a pandemic-related increase in online shopping led to e-commerce giants' profits to soar. The report entitled The Injury Machine, How Amazon's Production System Hurts Workers, was published by the Strategic Organizing Center, SOC, a democratic coalition that includes the Communications Workers of America, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Service Employees International Union, and United Farm Workers of America. The report states, noting the company's profits jumped from $21.3 billion to 2020 to $33.4 billion in 2021, Amazon's earnings in the first 12 months of the pandemic exceeded the previous 3 years combined. While shareholders and executives reaped the benefits of the company's soaring stock price, Amazon's aggressive growth has come at a high cost for its workers. The document adds, Amazon's high-pressure operations keep resulting in worker injuries in unprecedented numbers, and the situation is worsening. As documents details, from 2017 to 2021, the only year that Amazon's injury rates declined, 2020 was the same year that Amazon temporarily eased its work speed pressures as part of its response to COVID-19 pandemic by suspending disciplinary action against workers for underperformance on productivity metrics. However, in October 2020, just ahead of Prime Day, Amazon re-implemented its work rate, claiming to have revised its algorithms to accommodate COVID-related safety measures, yet workers reported that productivity pressures returned. The vast majority of these were serious, 34,001 or 89% of the injuries were categorized as either light duty or lost time injuries. That is, injuries where workers were hurt so badly that they were either unable to perform their regular job functions, light duty, or forced to miss work entirely, lost time, the report notes. Based on data Amazon submitted to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, SOC found that in 2021, there were 38,334 total recordable injuries, defined as those requiring medical treatment beyond first aid or requiring time off a worker's regular job at Amazon facilities. The analysis emphasizes that Seattle-based companies' injury rate over the last 5 years has been consistently high, above 7.4 injuries per 100 full-time equivalent workers in all but 1 year. The injury rate in 2021, 7.9 injuries per 100 workers, is the second highest rate in the past 5 years and a sharp increase from 2020. In a statement to Insider about the SOC's findings, Amazon spokesperson Kelly Nettle told that we hired tens of thousands of additional people to help us meet the unforeseen demand from COVID-19 and people turning to Amazon to help them safely get products and supplies during the pandemic. Like other companies in the industry, we saw an increase in recordable injuries during this time from 2020 to 2021. As we trained so many new people, Natal continued, noting that last year's figure is lower than 2019, which was just before the pandemic and featured Amazon's highest injury rate of the past 5 years. Putting Amazon's figures into context, the SOC report explains that in 2021, there were 7.7 injuries per 100 Amazon warehouse workers as compared to 4 injuries per 100 workers at all other warehouses. And the company's rate of serious injuries for such facilities was 6.8 per 100 workers as compared to 3.3 for all other employers in the warehouse industry. Before stepping down as CEO in April 2021, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, one of the richest people on the planet, wrote in a letter to shareholders that along with being Earth's most customer-centric company, we're going to be Earth's best employer and Earth's safest place to work. Citing that last pledge from Jeff Bezos' letter, the SOC document states that in response to rising scrutiny of its safety record, Amazon has scrambled to launch a public relations campaign to attempt to convince the public it is taking seriously. The company claims to have invested millions of dollars in initiatives intended to promote safety, and Amazon declared in April 2021 that it aims to cut injury rates by 50% by 2025, the report says. The SOC's analysis of Amazon's injury data for 2021 finds that the company has not only failed to make any progress on improving its injury rates, but has performed substantially worse than in the previous year, raising significant questions about Amazon management's commitment to preventing worker injuries.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK, and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom, alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hawza.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well. And I'm studying in Qom as well, in the sisters' Hawza. And my field of study is Fiqh and Usul. Fiqh and Usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence.
Very great. So, you are listening to this episode during the holy month of Ramadan. Therefore, may Allah accept all your prayers and may you enjoy a fruitful month spiritually and mentally. And make the best out of each second of this month in which our fate is going to be destined. So may Allah grant you all the blessings and don't forget us in your prayers. Now, in today's episode, we're going to discuss something that is related to the holy month of Allah, that is Ramadan. Now, before the holy month comes, there is a ritual in which they go to the mosques and they clean them. Also, there are plenty of people who do some specific cleansing before the holy month. I would like to dig a little bit deeper in that cleansing process.
You mean spiritual cleansing?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. We would want to know, how is it to start cleansing ourselves from the inside? How to go through that phase? Now let's start with Sister Sadiqa.
So the cleansing process does not start on the first of the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
If we see in the spiritual texts, It starts on the month of Rajab.
Mm-hmm.
These 3 months, Rajab, Sha'ban, and the month of Ramadan.
As the tutorials for the holy month.
Yes, exactly.
We have to practice.
We have to practice. And not only practice. You see, Allah is not going to throw us into the month of Ramadan in one shot and expect us to come out as saints on the other side on Eid. Mm-hmm. From the start of the month of Rajab, if we see, just let's take a book of du'as like Mafatih. If you see Rajab, they recommended fasts for the month of Rajab. Then they are
and
recommended.
There has been
du'as.
A great reward for that. Fasting in Rajab and Sha'ban before the holy month.
Yes, there's a lot of reward for that. But if we see the du'as of the month of Rajab focus a lot about Tawheed, is preparing the inner self to accept that
God is the only
banquet
one
that Allah is going to set up for us in the month of Ramadan. We usually refer to ourselves as the guests of Allah in the month of Ramadan,
exactly.
Right? How can you go to your host without understanding who he truly is? The month of Rajab starts off that process. It starts by introducing who Allah is. Then you come to the month of Sha'ban. Then you have Munajat al-Sha'baniyah. If you see that dua itself, it's completely filled with Tawheed from the start to the end,
yes,
asking
exactly.
Allah to forgive our sins, understanding who Allah is, understanding our own position in front of Allah.
And the concepts of those du'as and munajats prepare you for the cleansing of the holy month.
Yes. So when the first of Ramadan comes, and as we say, the devil is chained up, we've already chained up our inner devil as well.
How is it that for many people, Ramadan is the beginning of a change? It's like a new year for everyone.
It's the banquet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we've all been invited to. See, the sister's completely right. You know, the process of cleansing actually does start from Rajab and then Sha'ban. And then you have the Munajat of Sha'baniyah, which was one of Imam Khomeini's favorite du'as.
Just for those audience who do not know about Munajat al-Sha'baniyah, if you give us a little bit about that Munajat.
So the Munajat, they are the whispered prayers. There's lots of different types of du'as. Mm-hmm. We have du'a Kumail, we have du'a Tawassul. When it comes to the munajat specifically, these are whispered prayers. Mm-hmm. These are something very, very close and intimate that we can have between
very
Allah.
Very much spiritual and delicate and like it's talking from your mouth.
Absolutely. Actually, the point that I wanted to raise, however, is that yes, it does start in Rajab, it does start in Sha'ban. Mm-hmm. It can even be argued that actually it starts from the end of the last day of the Ramadan, the month of Ramadan of the previous year.
Exactly.
Right? Sometimes what happens is because our listeners are hearing this in the month of Ramadan, when you hear things like this, it gives you a sense of hopelessness. Like, oh, I didn't read it in the month of Sha'ban. I didn't do that spiritual cleansing in the month
of Rajab.
No,
you can do it whenever you like.
You know, and so then we have things like, you know, when is the best time to do repentance? It's at night, so I'll wait for night. It's in the shrine of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein, so I'll wait until I can do ziyarah. It's in Hajj, so I'll wait until I get the tawfiq to do Hajj. And it goes on and on and on.
You know, Allah gives us many chances to purify ourselves. Whatever sin we do, He gives us chances for tomorrow, for the day after tomorrow, for specific occasions. We have the time to purify ourselves from those sins.
But if I were to ask you, sister, when is the best optimum time to do repentance? Because the reality is the best time to repent, turn back to Allah, is here and now. Right now, it is the month of Ramadan. This is your golden opportunity to turn back to Allah. Those Quranic verses that you told yourself you're going to read, you're going to read, you're going to read. Read them now. That Salatul Layl that we keep on telling ourselves, we're going to wake up, we're going to pray it. Even Salatul Layl, it's a really good example. The night passes, we don't pray it. Then we think to ourselves, it's okay, I'll read it the next night. No, here and now you can read the qada of Salatul Layl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with all of these things. We're letting these opportunities pass. Here and now is when we can actually turn over that new leaf.
Exactly. Every second in our life is a moment that can change everything differently.
I'll wait until Laylatul Qadr,
exactly.
The night of Qadr. I'll wait until... No, don't wait.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might not live that long.
Exactly. We'll catch up very quickly.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
So we were talking about the cleansing process that happens during the holy month of Ramadan. Brother Muzaffar mentioned a very good point that seize the day. If you are going to go for a repentance, or if you are waiting for a time to go through a purification process, then do it right now. Maybe among the audience, there would be a person who would say, you speak about it very much easily. Tell us how you do it. How is it to start a purification process?
I'll tell you something that Imam Khomeini said, though. Mm-hmm. One of those great mystics, that arif, that true arif, that one person who really was a friend of Allah. One of the great scholars of the era said that Imam Khomeini, everywhere he looks, he sees only Allah. Imam Khomeini, in his book, 40 Hadith, which I would recommend everybody to read, even if you can't read it in Farsi or Arabic, read it in English, because I believe that the translation
exists. It's available, yes.
He talks about this spiritual purification process, and he says that, look, this journey is easy. It's easy. Okay, it's not difficult the way that people make it seem.
The journey of purification.
The journey of self-purification, the journey of submitting oneself entirely to the will of Allah. At the beginning, it may seem difficult. And one of the great tricks of shaitan, actually, is precisely this.
Is to make things look very huge.
Make it look massive. Make it look like a mountain. Mm-hmm. When you see a mountain and you're told you need to climb up it, suddenly you're not going to do that anymore.
Exactly.
But actually, what Allah is asking you to do is step on the pebbles.
Yes.
You know, all these tiny little rocks.
Start a step by step. As Sister Sadiqa said, we don't have to start it in the holy month. God has given us a chance to start it from Rajab and Shaban. So we have months in before the holy month to start the process of purification.
To follow up on Brother Muzaffar's mm-hmm. point, yes, the journey is easy. But what some people make the mistake of is putting a lot of pressure on themselves. And also because often when a soul is very raw, that intense pressure throws them down. When a person is starting off on the spiritual journey, there is no need to read the whole of Mafatih in one day.
Exactly.
Right? We have Ayatollah Behjat, who gives the most simplest, and he says this, we have the most amazing and the most simplest forms of spirituality, like salawat, reciting salawat a day.
Which
five
is
times.
Very much easy. You
Ten
sit in times. Your place and you recite that.
One tasbih takes 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. This in itself helps that soul to prepare to be able to continue the journey.
Exactly.
A soul that is raw is not going to be able to jump into it because that feeling of spirituality is not there. A lot of the times people start this journey and then they're like, I'm not getting anywhere. That's it. I'm going. That's the main mistake, because this journey takes time.
Now that we are going to start a spiritual journey, do you think it's going to have a lot of difficulties for us?
Yes, because the devil is always there. But we need to understand that reliance is only on Allah.
So what is going to carry us on?
I will give my own personal experience over here. Ayatollah Behjat's work, Ayatollah Behjat in many times.
Who was a scholar in our religion?
Ayatollah Behjat
as well.
was a scholar in Qom, who's also buried in the city of Qom. A great mystic.
Mm-hmm.
People say he might be the
he
best in the last 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
People used to come to him with different problems, and he would tell them, recite salawat with the niyyah of, with intention of solving your problem.
So we have to be steadfast with the plan that we are having.
We have to be steadfast, create a plan of how I want to progress. We're not going to ask someone to fast the whole year as soon as they start this journey.
Exactly.
Fast once a week, once a month, actually start fasting once a month. Then progress to twice a month, then progress to twice a week, then progress to thrice a week. Mm-hmm. And in this way, because fasting builds that willpower that you need to be able to continue this journey.
Yes, and we must be decisive. We should go for it steadfastly.
And not to put a lot of pressure in the initial stages. Mm-hmm. If you're not feeling well, apart from the month of Ramadan, that has its own rules, but apart from the month of Ramadan, if a person wants to begin fasting, if there's a specific day you're not feeling well, leave it. Because your intention is to fast for the sake of Allah.
Yes, you have
not
to enjoy
fast
that.
So that I can reach a specific stage. This is where people make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of fasting for the sake of Allah, they fast so that they can get to a specific spiritual stage, or they can get one of these karamat, they can get one of these or miraculous powers.
Or the rewards as well.
Yes. No, about rewards is another issue. Mm-hmm. I'm talking mainly about people might get into spirituality because they want to get these miraculous powers.
They're going too extreme.
Yes. But that takes you away from Allah because exactly. You're not fasting for the sake of Allah. You're not going through this journey for Allah now. You're going for your own soul, for your own ego. And it comes down to who you're fasting for. Who are you taking the spiritual journey to?
So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
A person may reach the highest levels just by doing the smallest of a'mal.
Exactly.
Some people endure the spiritual journey, mm-hmm. but it is for certain miraculous feats that they know they can accomplish.
Yes.
So, for example, teleportation. We know that some of the ulama could even do teleportation. Nabi Isa alayhi salam, the great prophet of Allah, he could walk mm-hmm. on water, which are humanly possible. Some people will start fasting, praying, reading the Quran in order to gain such powers,
yes.
right? Or even worse than that, to gain respect from the people or whatever it may be other than Allah. It's supposed to be only and only for the sake mm-hmm. of Allah so that Allah is pleased. Make Him pleased. Make Him the object of our worship. The second point, because we're running out of time, I just wanted to throw this in there as well. Yes, sometimes you can pressurize yourself to the extent that it leads you to a sense of despair. I'm mm-hmm. never going to reach anywhere. All right? And then you don't try and do anything at all. This is really bad. But at the same time, we need to exert ourselves. We need to push ourselves to the very limits of our ability. The Quran says, Ya ayyuhal insan, innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan fumulaqi. O human beings, you are striving a difficult striving, and you will continue to strive mm-hmm. until you reach your Lord. This is a struggle. Life is supposed to be a struggle. The only difference is, what are you struggling for? The Quran says, "Inna ma'al usri yusra." Surely with difficulty there is ease, right? So look at the prophets and imams. Look at how they strove. Look at Imam Khomeini. Look at the videos of his last moments in life where he is praying while people are standing on either side of him in the hospital to make sure that he doesn't fall and faint.
Yes.
These are our role models, and we should truly exert ourselves exactly. in the spiritual path for the sake of Allah.
Thank you, brother. So this was the whole time that we had for today's episode. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all.
Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك Let us see daylight again, once again.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
With U.S. President Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape in the United States looks grim for the Democratic Party. We now present you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Wave of U.S. House Democratic Retirement Stokes Fear for Party's Election Prospects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. For the Michigan Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, it was a question from her husband, when is our time? For the North Carolina Congressman, David Price, it was a judgment that the time has come to step down. Some retiring U.S. Democrats have blamed the gridlock and dysfunction on Capitol Hill, while others point to the redrawing of congressional maps. Still others cite the rise of political extremism and the deteriorating relations between members of Congress, particularly in the wake of 6th of January 2021 insurrection. Announcing his decision to retire last year, the Wisconsin congressman, Ron Kind, was frank. The truth is, I've run out of gas, he said. The decision not to seek re-election is both deeply personal and political. But as the party braces for a grueling midterm election this November, a rising number of House Democrats are opting not to return to Congress next year. The Florida congressman, Ted Deutch, announced that he would not seek re-election, bringing the total number of Democratic departures from the House of Representatives so far this cycle to 31. Among them, 8 Democrats are seeking other offices next year, like Tim Ryan of Ohio, who's running for the Senate, and Karen Bass of California, who's running to be mayor of Los Angeles. Some retiring members are powerful veterans, such as Kentucky's John Yarmuth, chair of the Budget Committee, and Oregon's Peter DeFazio, chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Others represent politically competitive districts, like Stephanie Murphy of Florida and Anne Kirkpatrick of Arizona. It's a worrying trend for Democrats. Congressional retirements are often an early sign of a wave election for the other party. In 2018, dozens of House Republicans did not seek re-election, including the then House Majority Leader Paul Ryan. The Republican Party lost 41 seats that year, and Democrats gained control of the chamber in an election cycle widely viewed as a referendum on Donald Trump. This year, the political winds are reversed. Republicans are trumpeting each retirement as a sign that Democrats' hopes of keeping their majority are fading. The National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC spokesman Mike Berg, said their majority is doomed. Either retire or lose. Though many vacancies are in safely Democratic districts, the rush of retirements among Democrats comes as the party faces significant historical headwinds. The president's party almost always loses seats in the midterm elections, and in the House of Representatives, Democrats can only afford to lose a handful of seats before surrendering control of the House. With Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and rising inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape looks grim for the Democratic Party. Adding to the uncertainty is a once-in-a-decade redistricting process when a state's congressional and legislative districts are redrawn. The House of Representatives is often a reflection of the national American mood, which public opinion shows is pessimistic. Voters are frustrated with their political leaders, and the Democratic Party is bracing for a backlash. In polling that asked voters which party they would support on Election Day as opposed to which congressional candidate, Republicans repeatedly hold the edge. In an interview, Price, an 81-year-old, said his decision to leave Congress after 3 decades was mainly personal and not circumstantial. During the Trump years, he said many long-serving Democrats postponed the decision to retire because they believed their experience was needed on Capitol Hill. Now they feel the time is right to retire. Price's new district is rated safely Democratic, and after a long redistricting battle, the North Carolina State Supreme Court recently approved congressional maps that are favorable to the Democratic Party. Kyle Condick, the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, said, "The number of retirements is naturally higher in years that end in 2 because those are redistricting cycles." It's been a brutal experience for some. Congressman Jim Cooper witnessed his reliable Democratic Nashville seat being carved up into 3 different districts that Donald Trump would have easily won in 2020. He decried the move as raw politics and an effort to dilute the electoral power of black voters. A day after the Tennessee legislature approved the map, Congressman Jim Cooper announced his retirement from Congress, where he had served for more than 3 decades. He said, "I explored every possible way, including lawsuits, to stop the gerrymandering and to win one of the 3 new congressional districts that now divide Nashville." He added, "There's no way, at least for me in this election cycle, but there may be a path for other worthy candidates." John Rogers, a Republican pollster who was the executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee during the 2018 midterm election cycle, says the retirements of powerful and long-serving Democrats is a strong sign that the Democratic Party is bracing for defeat this November. John Rogers added, "There are too many committee chairs retiring for this to be just about redistricting," adding that the prospect of losing a gavel or ending a lengthy career in the minority was unattractive to some politicians. Retirements deprive a party of the advantages that come with incumbency: fundraising, name recognition, and a deep understanding of their constituency, factors that are especially critical in competitive seats. Condick, author of The Long Red Thread, How Democratic Dominance Gave Way to Republican Advantage in U.S. House Elections, said, "Incumbency is not as valuable as it used to be, but open seats are generally harder to defend, particularly in a wave-style environment." Not since 1992 have so many House Democrats opted not to seek re-election. And with states still finalizing their congressional maps and candidate filing deadlines approaching, there might be more retirements to come. Condick said, "However bad it is to serve in Congress, it's worse to serve in the minority, particularly in the House." Notably bucking the trend, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced her decision to run again, extinguishing speculation that she would retire at the end of the term. Nancy Pelosi was re-elected as Speaker of the House after agreeing to step down from the role by the end of 2022. The Republican retirements, though far fewer, are also telling. As of this week, 15 House Republicans have said they won't run for re-election, with 7 running for another office. Among them are more moderate members, including Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and John Katko of New York, who have faced conservative backlash for voting to impeach former President Donald Trump. Democrats argue that much could change before the November elections. The COVID-19 pandemic appears to be in retreat, and officials claim the economy remains strong despite inflation. Joe Biden has started to ramp up his travel around the country, touting his legislative accomplishments. He has received rare bipartisan praise from his handling of the crisis in Ukraine, and Democratic voters are excited about his nominee for the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is poised to become the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court bench after a confirmation hearings later this month. And Republicans, they say, will have to answer for Donald Trump's enduring control over their party and the fallout from the congressional investigation into the events of 6th of January 2021, as well as for their efforts to restrict access to abortion and the ballot, issues that Democrats believe will rally voters to their side this cycle. Ian Russell, a Democratic strategist and former national political director with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said, "Most midterm elections, by their nature, are referenda on a party of power." But he said that by embracing Donald Trump's lies about election fraud and refusing to sanction their most extreme members, Republicans are helping frame the election as a choice between two parties with very different priorities, only one of which is going to wind up in charge. Last month, Lawrence, the Michigan congresswoman, surprised some of her colleagues when she announced that she would retire at the end of the term, after more than three decades in public service. She said in an interview, after 4 years of Donald Trump's administration, the COVID-19 pandemic, 6th of January, it was a death by a million cuts. Lawrence, who represents a heavily Democratic district and is the only black member of Michigan's congressional delegation, said she feels good about her legacy and would continue to be active in her community in other ways. "I'm not going home to plant flowers," she said. She hopes her departure will make room for a new generation of black lawmakers who will bring fresh urgency to the battles over women's reproductive rights, voting protections, and police reform. She said, "I came into Congress when we were in the minority, but I came in with the intent to make a difference, and I hope that continues to motivate American citizens to step up into public service, because there is work to do."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.